You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome back to TFM's local watering hole. I am so excited to be here with, it'll actually be the last show of 2025, and we have a monster movie to talk about as we return to the world of Pandora. And I'm really excited to have back with me my good friend, Rye. Rye, welcome back to 602 Club, man.
Dude, thanks. I've been looking forward to this, talking about this movie especially. It's just fun to be on and chat about movies, so thanks for having me.
Of course, dude. I mean, the funny thing is when you came on the first time, we were talking about, you know, when you might be able to come back on, and I mentioned, like, dude, would you want to talk Avatar? It's like, I haven't really been able to find anybody who's really super interested, and you're like, dude, yes. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, thank God.
So. Yeah. It's funny because, like, I mean, we'll talk about it, but, like, I'm not, like, an Avatar head. I'm not, like, a James Cameron defender or anything. Yeah. So, but I just knew it's going to be the most highest grossing movie of the year. How can you not talk
absolutely.
About it?
I mean, yeah, its start already was insane. But before we dive into everything, just find us wherever you get your podcasts. We'd really appreciate it if you give us a star rating review over on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Share the show over on X Twitter at the 602 Club. We're also on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. We've got the entire network on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. And then, of course, you can find the website at trek.fm and see all of the different shows that are going on here. And if you'd like to support us, you can go over to Patreon at patreon.com/TrekFM as well. So since this is, you were starting to talk about this before, right? So as we just kind of come into this, this is the third movie in the Avatar series. And so you mentioned a little bit like coming in, it's not like Cameron's your favorite director or anything, but how are you feeling off the second film, Way of Water, coming into this movie? Were you pumped or were you like, oh man, I don't know?
Yeah, I think, like I said, James Cameron's not my favorite director or anything. He's made fantastic movies. He's also made movies and I'm like, whatever. Specifically, the first Avatar, I don't care for really at all. Each time I watch it, I'm like, wow, I like this movie less and less. But each time I watch Way of Water, I like it more and more. I remember the first time I saw it in 22 and I was like, this is good. This is a step up, but still, Avatar, Pandora, the world was cooler than the movie was for me. But I mean, my last rewatch of Way of Water before Fire and Ash, I was like, I'm pumped. I'm really excited for how they're going to expand, what they're going to do. The trailers had me excited. So, I was pretty jazzed about going into it to see it. Are you
nice?
Are you similar?
So I'm similar in the sense of, when the original Avatar came out, I was not like a massive fan.
Mm-hmm.
A big part of that was the movie itself, just felt so generic in many ways, I felt like.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was, is that then Way of Water came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was incredibly impressed. It was one of those things where I didn't realize how good a director could take a movie to which I wasn't impressed by and then do a thing that I didn't expect, which is make me actually care about a movie that I didn't think that I was going to care about. And so that was pretty impressive to me. I mean, again, like I'm like you, there wasn't really anything about the first one that I was blown away by. There wasn't anything where I thought, okay, this is the deal. This is it, mm-hmm. And yet The second one, I actually came out of the theater and I was kind of blown away. And not only were the special effects even better than the first movie, which I mean, the first movie still has that, right? James Cameron, more than anybody, understands the idea of spectacle and what he's doing with 3D and all of that. I mean, it was just amazing. And so I was astounded. And so, I thought it was great in that sense. And, you know, what's funny to me as well is that going back and then watching the original film, it grew on me.
Okay.
Now when I say that, what I mean is it grew on me and like half a star grew on me. It's not like it, you know, really became a thing. I think it went from like 3 to 3.5, right?
Okay.
But that's it. I still it's still not my favorite. But the series really grew on me because of that second film. So, I mean, coming into this one, I was thinking to myself, oh my gosh, okay, so you did a thing that I didn't think possible. You made me care about this world when I didn't think that was possible. And now, so coming into this third one, I'm actually pretty pumped, pretty excited, and pretty ready to go. And I wanted to ask you about this. This isn't even on the outline, but this is obviously a follow-up to the second movie. But did you feel like at all that this is actually almost like part two of part two, more than necessarily just a third film in the series?
Yeah, to a certain extent, yes. I think that right now there's a lot of discourse online of just saying this is just Avatar 2.5, and they're using that as a negative thing to just criticize the movie for some reason. And I think, like, to a certain extent, yes. Like, there's elements of it that, I mean, both these movies, like, this was supposed to be one movie, like, originally, from what I understand, what James Cameron has said in interviews, is that, like, all this stuff was supposed to be in one thing. Obviously, it's too much for one movie, so they split it up. But I think there's enough here that it feels distinct, it feels different, but there's elements of it that I see and understand stuff with whales and stuff with, you know, the RDA that feels very connected. But it didn't bother me like it is bothering some. I thought there was plenty different where I was like, it's also like, what does George Lucas say about Star Wars? He's like, it's like poetry. These sort of things rhyme. Like it's the same universe. Of course it's going to feel similar. What do you think about the connectedness of it?
And I'm sure people are thinking, oh man, maybe he's already off on a negative front here. You know, he's on the negative Nancy foot. And no, I'm not. I'm actually saying that is a positive in the sense that this movie just literally picks up where the last movie left off.
Totally.
Right. And so in that sense, there is a continuation of story here. So it makes sense as well that a lot of what is trying to be wrapped up here in this third movie is all of the stuff that's gotten set up in the first two, right? And so the fact that there's going to be some similar themes, there's going to be some similar beats in some senses and all of that, to me, actually really makes sense. And I'm not seeing it as a detriment to the film. I'm seeing it as more of like, okay, but are you completing then what you started well?
Yeah.
And that's really all that matters, you know, because if you're taking what you've given us and you're bringing it to completion in a way that feels satisfactory, that's what matters in filmmaking. And to me, I 100% believe that this film satisfactorily fulfilled its obligation in the story elements that it has been giving us. And maybe that's giving away too much right at the beginning, but like that's just where I am with this. I'm not frustrated that this has a lot of similarities with the second movie and even the first movie, right? Yeah.
It feels very like episodic almost, where it's not like it feels like just another chapter in the Sully's life where it's continuing on, and you know, towards the end, like there's conclusions, but there's still story to be told. And if people don't find that satisfying, that's fine. But I still am about when I'm walking out, I'm satisfied with the end product and feel good about it.
Well, and on that too, so mentioning the fact that this really just kind of picks up where the last movie left off, right? Mm-hmm. The Sully family has lost a sibling and a child. And in many ways, this whole movie is very much a kind of a meditation on loss and how you handle that, especially here, I would say, for a good two-thirds of the film.
Oh, yeah.
The characters are really dealing with those ramifications and the way in which those ripples then impact every single part of the family, mm-hmm. but also their new extended family here with this new tribe at the reef. And so I just wanted to ask you about that because, I mean, really, that drives a good part of this story.
Yeah, I think it's really, I like it a lot. I think even with the naming of the movie of Fire and Ash, it's like everything has been destroyed. Like these characters, Neytiri, Jake, Loak, like, and even beyond, like you said, but those main three, obviously, in the biggest way, are dealing with this loss of a child and of a brother, to the point of like they're grieving in just different ways, which is super interesting. Like Jake is trying to fight back; he's trying to gather supplies to continue this fight against the RDA. Neytiri has lost everything. She says, "All I have is my faith. Like Awa will provide. Awa, you know." And then Loak is like, he is. The movie opens in this really beautiful way where he's like in this, you know, whatever their heaven is, I guess, with his brother
In the spirit world. Yeah,
yeah, and that's like he's spending time with his brother in that way, but he comes back to reality and his brother's gone, and he feels, I mean, just absolute heartache. And I really appreciated it. I think to open the movie in this way, it's like, all right, there's no fluff. There's nothing like, all right, here's what we're just kind of hanging out. It's like, no, what happened last movie really matters to our characters. And picking up from that point it's a really good move from James Cameron. So I appreciated it.
Yeah, because I mean, I think in that sense too, it kind of hits something that's a theme throughout this entire series, and of course, in the last film, this film, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of like the choices we make and the impact that they can have, good or bad, right? And so, you know, the choices that Loak and his brother make at that moment to go back for Spider,
yeah,
it has an impact, right? Now they save Spider's life, but you know. He dies. And then Spider decides to save Quaritch, you know? And so that has so there's a lot of
ripple effects.
A lot of ripple effects. And this movie, again, it's so much about the way in which choices kind of impact the rest of our lives, right? For good mm-hmm. or ill. And, mm-hmm. and not only, it's just like, The fact that, you know, Loak is feeling so defeated, so discouraged, you know, he's contemplating suicide. I mean, there's a moment where he's going to attempt suicide.
I was blown away. I was like, wow, I can't believe this has happened. Like, this is, like, it's very well done. I don't want to say it's very good because mm-hmm. it's so heavy, but, like, I was right. like, dang, you really went there. This is special stuff.
Yeah, well, and I think... I like what you said in the sense that I think it is really well done, but I also think that it's actually just a really important thing I think in our world. You know, suicide itself has been something that we have I think seen be on the rise, and I think to see that honestly and openly in this film. Is actually pretty beautiful, and I think the way mm-hmm. it was dealt with was incredibly tactful and really well done.
Yeah, because
you know, Kiri comes and says, like, we need you in this life.
Uh-huh,
like,
yeah.
We need you in this, like, and being a person who that has been a thought in my life, like, mm-hmm. that's actually, you know, I've been there, right? To see that on screen, I thought it was really well done. And on the flip side of that, right, with Neytiri, who her hatred of humanity that she now harbors is actually impacting the relationships with her kids and her husband.
Which is another element that's so good.
Yes.
Sorry to cut you off. I'm just like the conversation that she has with Jake, where they're talking about, you know, the sky people, and he's like, our kid, like, I'm a sky person. Our kids are part sky people. Like, do you hate these things? You know, the raw, like, vulnerability of, like, what she, like, her legitimate hatred and, you know, just disdain for humans because of what she dealt with. It was like, it was extremely powerful. It was extremely moving, and like, I can't believe an Avatar film is actually continuing to just dig deeper and deeper and deeper into these human emotions that we do feel based off of, like you said, the choices that are made for good or for bad in our life.
Well, and I think not only that, but the rawness and the realness of not negating the way in which these type of things actually impact us as people, right? Mm-hmm. As beings. And the realness then in this marriage, right? Of having these discussions, to which, you know, both you and I are married, and mm-hmm. we've known lots of married people, and we've heard plenty of conversations about, or maybe we've had conversations with our spouses where it's like, mm-hmm. you know, you say the thing that you can't take back.
Yeah.
And there's a pain and a wound that gets opened there because you said something that, whether or not it's true, it's just leaves a gaping hole.
Yeah.
And the beauty of this, and what I loved about this whole thing is that they have this incredibly raw conversation, and yet, and it, you can tell it causes Jake an immense amount of pain.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he doesn't respond in kind. Right. He mm-hmm. in the sense of like when he confronts her about saying, hey, do you hate my kids? Do you hate mm-hmm. our kids? Do you hate me? Basically, does anything anytime anything go wrong, you're just blaming it on the human in us. And when she says yes, I mean, he just.
Yeah, it's like
the way he comes back to her and he wraps his arms around her. He apologizes. And then. He reminds her that this family is their fortress. There's something incredibly beautiful about that, because sometimes, whether or not it's the right thing to say, things need to be put out in the open,
mm-hmm.
Just so that they can be dealt with and then let go of. And in that moment, I almost feel like that conversation, and I don't know if you agree or not, but it does feel like, once Neytiri is actually able to verbalize it, it does help her begin to actually deal with this, because her attitude does begin to change throughout the rest of the film. And by the end, that's not her attitude, right? And I think there's something really interesting about that.
Yeah, I agree. It the verbal processing of it allows her to start to heal, start to like reconcile these obviously horrible thoughts she's having about her family and about, you know, Spider and, you know, people she cares deeply about. But her bottling it in, which so often people do, they like, we see this is a direct, like we see it on the internet, like people bottle in hatred and then they let it out in these unhealthy ways. But in here, we're getting this like beautiful conversation between a husband and a wife who, once it's said and able to be processed, she's not met with like this could change totally depending on how Jake obviously reacts to her, where she's met with grace and love from her husband saying, I love you. This family is our fortress. You know, like we're in it till the end. And then it gives space for her to continually work out these feelings until then they're shifted by the end of the movie. And there's a scene that we'll talk about later that is probably my favorite of the movie. I mean, there's a lot at this point, because you could say this conversation is my favorite of the movie. Like,
yeah.
The more I'm thinking about this movie, like, wow, this is actually so good.
Yeah.
But yeah, so.
Well, and what I think is really beautiful about this whole thing is that by not pretending like this isn't an earth-shattering event, which could rip apart this family, as it does many families. I mean, the statistics, and I don't know the actual numbers, but I know it's very high for marriages to end after the loss of a child.
Yeah, that sounds pretty accurate.
And so, because of that, I think what's smart about the film is to deal with the raw, real emotions of characters and not to shy away from them. And in that, what you're doing is you're following the character story. You're not just making them have to do a thing for the plot. It's like, no, this is the plot because that's where these characters are, and we got to deal with that. And I think that is really good storytelling. And for me, I would say, you know, the last two Avatar films are actually probably James Cameron's best films when it comes to actual character emotions. I don't think that's really his strong suit in writing in all of the films of his that I've seen.
Yeah.
And yet in these two films, I think it really works. And, you know, what's interesting is that I was listening to a quick interview. I don't know where it came. It was maybe on Instagram or something. But Zoe Saldana was talking about the conversations that Zoe Saldana and James Cameron and Sam Worthington were having to have with the loss of this son. Like, this isn't something that any of them, she was like, we didn't want to do this, right? This is not a thing we wanted to add to our acting repertoire of like having to deal with the loss of a child. And yet they did. And I think then actually dealing with the ramifications of that in this film is what makes this a smart move. And I think too, it just, you know, there's a part of this where it helps make this kind of a messier movie in that sense, because it's emotionally all over the place because so are our characters emotionally. And that's a part of it. And so one of the things that's really a wise choice, I think, in this movie is that, you know, we watched in the first film Sully make the choice once he's experienced the Na'vi way of life, once he's experienced the bond with all of Pandora creation, once he's had his eyes opened to all of this, right? He makes the choice to turn and to be on that side. And I thought what was great about this film is that, you know, all throughout this series, you know, Quaritch has been the adversary of Sully. But I think what was smart is actually to make him finally the dark mirror of Jake. And that really accentuates every theme that, you know, Cameron has been working with since the first film.
Yeah. I totally agree. I think Quaritch has always been a villain that, like, I remember when he came back last movie, I was like, all right, whatever. Like, I get the progression, but still, are we doing Quaritch again? And then obviously gets saved at the end of Way of Water. And I was like, you know, I'm like, are we really going to do Quaritch again? And so coming into this, my only hesitation was like, I didn't care for Quaritch. I was like, he's uninteresting. He's just a military guy, you know, typical machismo, whatever, villain. And then it just told, I mean, it's the most interesting he's ever been. Because he is like directly, like you said, he's direct, a literal just mirror of Jake. He's embracing this culture. He's a different side of the culture with the fire tribe. He's experiencing it. He's in it more. Like it becomes less about this. It's still about Jake and capturing Jake, but he's like succumbing to all the things that Jake did, but Jake chose to see and believe and adopt it, while like Quaritch is like half-heartedly doing it. He's taking some stuff and he's trying to stay back still, because I mean him and Jake are having conversations, which I also thought was very fascinating. Some of them very, very funny, where they're just like helping each other and like, well, now what? And it's like, this is kind of funny.
Like, well, I'm tired.
He's like, this is awkward. I was like, that's hilarious. Like, that's so funny. But I think that the move to make Quaritch not just another, like a human essentially just in a blue body, like he's like becoming Na'vi, like he's like, I thought it was a very smart move, and it accentuates everything that Jake has gone through, and you see his progression in becoming this leader, this hero amongst the Na'vi. So I was so out on Quaritch, and by the end of this movie I'm like, that was really smart. It was great.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating because, you know, Quaritch here in this film, like you said, he has the same trajectory as Jake does, and yet the side of the Na'vi people that he is embracing is the side that reinforces his own beliefs, right? Mm-hmm. Which is that life is a strict us versus them, that there's no enlightenment other than the fact that there's nothing beyond this world other than to take what we can get, than to be, you know, offered power. And in so many ways, I was really struck by the way in which I think he mirrors the character of Satan in Paradise Lost, you know, who famously says it's better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
Yeah.
And because he's offered grace, he's offered redemption, he's offered enlightenment, and yet he completely rejects it.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't want to give any of this up. He doesn't see the reason to, because he willingly keeps his eyes closed. You know, Sully says to him many times, basically, have your eyes opened. You have the eyes to be able to see.
Mm-hmm.
So actually open them and see. And he chooses not to. Mm-hmm. He makes the decision to reject it wholeheartedly. And what's fascinating is, you know, on the other side, Sully, even though he struggles with the spiritual existence on Pandora, he does have his eyes opened.
Yeah.
That there is something larger now that he's connected to. And he's realized that it is important to be connected to something larger than himself. You know, in the sense of understanding the symbiosis to the world, and understanding that he's meant to be a good steward of the world of Pandora and not just exploit it. I mean, you know, spiritually speaking, it's all the things that we would think of the way in which, you know, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden are handed the Garden of Eden by God and said, and he's like, take care of this, right? Mm-hmm. And then they don't, of course.
Yeah.
and that's the exact same thing that Cameron is playing with all of those ideas here, where, you know, humanity has come to Pandora and to basically take advantage of it in the same way that it took advantage of Earth.
Yeah.
I could say stronger language, but this is a family-friendly show. So, and Sully is a person who, again, he's had his eyes open to say, hey, if we embrace Pandora as it is, as the ecosystem it is, as this thing that's bigger than ourselves, it actually leads to a better, more fulfilling life than if we just tried to take advantage of it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you see, like you said, Jake struggles with it. Like, he struggles with the spirituality of it. He struggles with, like, you know, Neytiri saying Awa will provide. And he's like, you know, like, he questions all this stuff, but you really see what he actually believes in those conversations with Quaritch, because deep down he's like, it like removes his like blinders a little bit, because he's aware, but him pushing back with the people he's closest with, then his enemy, who he's like, dude, you could just have all this that I have. Like, I find it very fascinating where he, with Neytiri, is like questioning, even though he sees, but with Quaritch, he's like, you could experience all this beauty, all this, you know, you could steward all this stuff, you could have it all. Like, there doesn't need to be any more, you know, like his human, like he says, Quaritch is gone. Like, who you were, like, it doesn't exist anymore. He died. Like, you're this whole new being, whole new person. Like, just accept it and live in it. And it's just cool. It's a cool conversations that they're continually having in, you know, these really awkward, you know, moments in between after fighting or running from the fire people or whatever. And, yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see if it happens in the future. I don't know what they're going
to
do there.
I mean, you know, I think the thing to me as well that makes this great is the fact that, you know, this whole series, look, this is not, you know, a monotheistic type. I mean, this is a very pantheistic type of idea. Mm-hmm. But what Cameron is tapping into here is the idea of faith, right? Mm-hmm. Is the idea that there's something bigger that we can be a part of, right? And he's using this kind of more pantheistic sensibility to tell that story. And yet, what we're seeing it also, I think, told through are, I would argue, through kind of a more Christian-like lens, in the sense of, like, everything is kind of seen in this idea of, you know, you can become part of this thing if you give yourself to it. You know, mm-hmm. you become part of the bigger whole.
Mm-hmm.
If you give yourself to it, if you allow yourself, you know, to be given redemption, basically. To all of this type of stuff plays out throughout this film, and I just find that to be really interesting, because so many films, you know, other than, like, you know, the Star Wars series, which doesn't shy away from its spiritual side, because that was Lucas's whole point. Mm-hmm. You know, so many films these days, I would say the Marvel series in general is one that either mocks religion or tends to downplay it or anything like that. And, you know, Avatar, on the other hand, basically is saying, no, maybe our lives would be better as human beings if we had a little bit more faith.
Mm-hmm.
If we actually, and then we allowed that faith to impact the ways that we lived, because that's exactly what happens here. You know, with a lot of the Na'vi people, not all of them, of course, because mm-hmm. that's what we get in this film. But yeah. I find that to be really interesting for, you know, one of the biggest film franchises in the last 20 years to be saying.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well. I remember, like, Avatar, like, there's always been the spirituality towards the franchise, but this movie in particular felt like distinctly the most Christian. Like, just things jumping off the screen where I was like, oh my, like, over and over and over again, there's like these themes and this imagery that I'm like, it's like overwhelming to a sense, seeing just all that James Cameron is wrestling with and dealing with and trying to communicate, and like very on the nose in some points where I'm like, yeah, man, keep going. This is great. Keep doing this.
Well, and speaking of that, I mean, I think, you know, we can't negate the fact that one of the big questions in this film is the problem of evil, which is one of the most classic questions when you talk about God in general at all, right? You know, mm-hmm. how could a good God allow bad things to happen to good people is the question.
Totally.
And so the fact that we're going to be meditating on the problem of evil is so interesting. And, you know, the question of, you know, why wouldn't a good God or, you know, a good spiritual being intervene on behalf of their people, you know, mm-hmm. And it's a question that the Tiri and Jake and Varang and Kiri and all of these people deal with, right? And I think it's interesting because you really have different ways of dealing with the problem of evil, right? You mm-hmm. either kind of take the Natiri stance, which is that you lean deeper into your faith and trust that this being has a good plan that you can't see because you're not that being.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're like Varang and the Ash, who completely reject their faith and just embrace hedonism, atheism, power, and basically pure evil. I mean, you know, I don't think Cameron really shies away of basically kind of making them almost like weird Satanist type cult thing.
Totally.
You know, crazy. At all. Yeah. And so I found that fascinating.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's you definitely get the polar opposites with like Natiri and with Varang. Varang, she explains like what she went through and the volcano and how it destroyed everything. And she just fully leans into like fire and ash and evil and this lifestyle. Like they have scenes, obviously it's like more like sexual, especially with Quaritch, which I was like, this is really interesting. I did not expect this at all. And then there's like the drug stuff where then she's got the eye on her hand. And like there's a whole scene with Quaritch where they're doing drugs or something, or he did some sort of drug. And it's, just so self-indulgent. Everything's meaningless. Let's just lean in to like take what we can get, kill what we can kill. Like she says, like fire is the most pure thing. And it's the thing that, you know, destroys and destructs. And on the opposite side, then you have Neytiri leaning in. You have like Kiri, the Sigourney Weaver character, which is still weird, but that's a different conversation. But she's constantly like praying to Awa and like, Awa, why are you silent? Why are you not responding? Why are you not helping? Which pairs directly with this problem of evil. These bad things are happening. Why are you not stepping in to help us, to save us, to save Spider, to, you know, she's going and she puts her, I forget what they're called, her tail thing to the spirit world. And she's like met with like opposition almost. And it was a real picture for like in different outlets, how people react towards this problem of evil, to the silence of God, or what they deem to be the silence of God, or what they believe. And I thought it was really well done. I thought like you could see people that, you could see yourself in each of these characters to some extent, and how you've responded or reacted, like wanted to push away God because you went through something. You're like, how could you allow this to happen? I'm just going to lean into the depravity, into the destruction, or I'm so helpless. I need you so badly, God. Like I thought it was really well done. And again, it's just another theme that Cameron's playing with, that it's like there's so many things, but it's like this controlled mess that works really, really well.
Well, and I think, mentioning the whole idea of just the ash culture, right? And what do they do? The characters are terrifying in the sense that they just feel like, I called them weird Aztec dementors, because they're willing to steal the life force of another being. They worship at the altar of power and hedonism and atheism, basically. Yeah. And so what's interesting in that sense is that, a lot of people kind of knock this as just basically being a movie that's like, anti-colonization and, feeling like that and all those things, which, that's part of this film. But I think what was great about this movie is actually to see that Na'vi culture isn't monolithic. Just like our world, there are different sects of belief. And I think that was really smart to show, because it means that humans are not the only enemies on Pandora. Mm-hmm. Humans aren't the only ones who could destroy Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
Ash tribe actually wants to destroy this world in a way that's almost worse than humanity, because humanity wants it at least to survive, because Earth is dying.
At least they want to use it.
They just basically want to, what is it in The Dark Knight? Some people just want to watch the world burn, and that's exactly who the Ash are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're just these people that just literally want nothing but destruction for... Like, I think the scene, like, I don't even know if we get the reason why they attack the Wind Traders. They just attack, just for the heck of it. They just, and you see, there's like a glimpse. I wish we got a little bit more of it in the end, but like, there's this like Mad Max vibe to their attack where, this guy like is holding this bag above his head.
Oh, clearly, yeah. With, they're, They're kamikazes.
Yeah, she shoots her fire bow at him, and he lights on fire, and it dives into the ship. And I was like,
that was nuts.
I was like, this is crazy. Which perfectly just describes exactly their philosophy of life and what they believe, and that they don't care what happens. They just want to pleasure themselves and destroy things. It's crazy.
Well, and one of the things I think that you mentioned too was fascinating in this whole discussion, right, is that one of the core themes of the film is that the light always returns.
Mm.
And, you know, they have the eclipse that happens every day. And so in this idea is that even when we can't see the supernatural power working, that it is, and it always returns, right, that it even more so than the sun, it comes through, you know, even when we don't expect it. And, you know, that's what happens. And I mean, you know, I don't want to get too literal here, but it does take three characters to finally reach the warrior mother, which, you know, whatever. I wanted to ask you about this because, you know, a big part of Way of Water was the pacifism of the Tulkun.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie really challenges the idea of if pacifism is a viable philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say the answer that they come up with is no.
Yeah. I thought about this because I heard people talk about it in a podcast. I've been listening to some podcasts about this as well. And I hear, you know, some different takes. And it was interesting. Because I didn't know what they were going to do. Like, first of all, the whole Tulkun Council thing and like how they were like so sick. That was awesome. But it almost is like, I was thinking about it, like it's almost like just war theory kind of. Like, if that's the way it plays out, where it's like full pacifism is not the way. Generally, that should be the way of life. But in order to defend their people, their species, their kind, like we have to fight back in this way. Cause this is like almost like like Loak and Pyakon, like help the elders see that like we need to defend, and not just let everybody die, and be murdered. Like that full pacifism actually is not a good idea. Even though generally it is good, but they finally met this unique circumstance where like the rubber met the road officially. It's like, what do you do? And I thought it was interesting being like, it's not a good idea when it actually meets and you're like, you gotta do something about this. You can't just let all the children and the calves and the mothers all just be slaughtered. That's what I kind of thought about it. What'd you think? What was your take on their response to what Loak and Pyakon were trying to push them towards?
Yeah, I think that the main question becomes, you know, is there anything worth fighting for? And mm-hmm. is fighting always wrong? I mean, those are the questions that they're dealing with. And obviously, their history previously had shown them that it was not the right thing to do. And a big part of that was because of the inner battles between different Tulkun
mm-hmm.
who were hurting their society.
Yeah.
And yet, if you're not willing to stand up for your society when somebody's trying to literally destroy it, mm-hmm. and your society ceases to exist, is that the moral right thing to do? You know?
Yeah.
And so, totally. You know, I think you mentioning the idea of like just war theory, I think this is really what it comes down to in the sense of, you know, in the fight for survival, the fight for existence against an evil empire,
mm-hmm.
you know, against a ideology and a group of people who basically want your extinction,
right?
Then it is okay to defend oneself. And I think that's mm-hmm. where we come down with the Tulkun. And you know, the choice between not living and living is like, you know, even if you believe you're going to live in the spirit world, the problem also, right, is that for them, their spirit world is tied to Pandora. So if Pandora itself ceases to exist, they will cease to exist forever as well. And so, I mean, you know, it's not even like, oh, we die and we go to heaven. It's like, well, yeah, but your heaven is tied to the world that you actually live on. And so therefore, I mean, this makes this discussion much more salient in the sense of like, yeah, if we don't fight, we could lose literally everything forever.
Yeah, and it's not like this question to fight even other Na'vi or peaceful people. It's not like, let's do this unjustly. It's like, there's an enemy. We have people to protect. We should fight back. And it, like you said, it makes it an easier decision. Obviously, they're like, we'll think about it. But to me, it'd be like, if someone met me with that question, I'd be like, yeah, I think it's just, I think it's the right thing to fight for these people, species that you love.
Right. Which, as the narrator in Arrested Development say, they did. one of the things that, and it's probably, I would say the most powerful scene in the film. And there's this moment where it seems like a possible sacrificial human might be needed to save the Na'vi way of life forever. And the choices then, again, we talked about this idea of choices having ripple effects. And I wanted to ask you about this, the choice that Jake makes with Spider and then the reaction of Neytiri to that.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think it might be my favorite scene in the movie. I mean, it's coming off the heels of a sweet action scene in like base camp for the humans with Neytiri and Varang and Jake and Spider. Just awesome. So you're coming off this really high. And yeah, it's like Abraham and Isaac-esque. Like, that's what it reminded me of when I was watching it. And I mean, it's so emotional because they really do make you believe like it's going to happen. Like Jake is going to kill Spider because it's necessary, because his body has changed. And therefore, if they can get Spider, they can make it a whole lot easier to, you know, colonize or take over Pandora, which would obviously be a very bad thing. And so when it was happening, I mean, even the dialogue towards the end where he's like, Dad, do you love me? And he's like, with all my heart. I'm just like, oh my, like, this is really, I'm like, this is really going to happen. And, you know, he even calls out to the Great Mother, I think, in that he's like, give me a sign. Like, what do I do? And he chooses not to, because I think it's so ingrained within his DNA of a of his character to not do that. The person that has been influencing him to do these things has been Neytiri. Neytiri is the one that has wanted to kill Spider, that doesn't care if he was dying because he lost his gas or his mask with his air. And the choice obviously was powerful, and like, this is not going to be the way that this has to happen. We're going to choose a different way. But then it cuts simultaneously to Neytiri, who would want this to happen, who doesn't care. She hates Spider. And, you know, she has this conversation with Jake. And throughout the film, again, James Cameron's really playing with Christian imagery here. Loak, who narrates the film, is like, they say the water washes you clean. They say it washes away your sins. And so that's being repeated. Neytiri struggling with the loss of her son, you know, hatred towards sky people, hatred towards Spider. And she is at the riverbank in the forest, which is where she is home. Like, the forest is her home. She's a forest Na'vi. And she's wearing the makeup of the ash people, of destruction, of evil, of hedonism, of self-indulgence, all these things. And she's like it's like a light switch fully just emerges, and she recognizes, like, everything that she's been dealing with, the conversation with Jake, all comes to a head because he's going to kill Spider. Mm-hmm. And she finally gets it, and she takes the water, which washes you clean and wipes away this evil, this destruction. And I mean, this is like so good.
Great.
So powerful. Like, such a, I mean, James Cameron's probably not thinking this, but like, living water washes away your sins, John 4.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, yeah.
So I'm just like, dude, this is amazing. And she runs towards him. And then, oh, this scene's so good. She goes to him and she's like, I see you. Like, the phrase that they say as a people, as a species of like, it's like saying, I love you, basically. It's like, I see you, Spider. Like, she's fully embracing him into their family, where I'm just like, I have
well,
to get
I mean,
it.
Okay. Yeah, can so, we talk I, about the fact, so good. We got to talk about this fact too, is that, and this has been happening throughout this entire series, right? But what are we seeing happen with all of these different people being brought into the Na'vi way of life? They're literally being grafted in to the family, mm-hmm. right? And Spider specifically is grafted into the family because Kiri, through the power of Ewa and her abilities, helps Spider merge with one of the and I can't remember what they're called.
I forget. It was a weird word.
But they're one of the special, you know, they're the little floating spirit things that you'll see. And she pulls that apart, puts it down his throat, and through the power of Ewa, creates a symbiotic relationship where it allows him to breathe their air and basically become Na'vi because, you know, he grows the...
The Kuda. That's what it is.
And it allows them... So there's something so interesting that's happening in these films. And again, I mean, it's one of those places where, you know, Cameron's playing with, like Lucas did, all sorts of, you know, spiritual ramifications from all sorts of different types of religions, you know. But what's fascinating is that I think so many of these things come together to create a story that's much richer and deeper because of that. And so, yes, I mean, that scene, I just love the way that you were describing it, because there is such emotion in that scene. And the beauty of that, too, there's that moment where Spider says, I know I have to die. Like, he knows that because he's lived with the Na'vi people enough, he knows the danger that this change in him could have on the ecosystem of this planet. If human beings can do this the same way, you know, he has, it could be game over. And so there's something so beautiful about that. And I think the other part about this, and I wanted to ask you about this as well, this might be the most pro-family film series I've ever seen in my entire life, because not only are we talking about the nuclear family, which, you know, doesn't get a lot of play these days, but we're also talking about the family of adoption. And, you know, those two things are so incredibly beautiful that I'm just kind of blown away with the way in which Cameron's kind of, you know, trad lifestyle is really on play here. And I'm here for it, man. I'm here for it 100%.
You have a wife who loves and respects her husband. That doesn't get a lot of play either.
Could you say that again? She what?
She loves and respects her husband.
Oh, I'm like, sorry. I hadn't heard of that before. So yeah. At least in film these days. So and on top of that, you have a husband who loves and respects his wife.
Dude, you have shocker. I'm just going to use biblical language here. You have literally such a clear picture it's not perfect, but a pretty clear picture of like Ephesians 5, right? You have this wife who loves, respects, submits to her husband, and this husband who loves, respects, and sacrifices himself for his wife and his family. Like, in in the movies that are going to make the most amount of, like, it's going to be like $6 billion amongst three films. Like, this is ridiculous.
Which is insane.
So it's like, this is the most popular, one of the most popular franchises ever, at least financially speaking. It's got three movies now, and it is a display of a traditional husband and wife and the nuclear family, and like, family is everything. It's important, and you do everything you can for them. And not only that, is that like, if you're adopted, like, you become a part of this family. Like, you learn with Kiri and you learn with Spider that there's no like outsider. It's not like you don't matter. It's like you're brought in willingly. Obviously took Nictiri a little bit longer, but that's her character development. But in general, Spider's welcome into the Sully family. And even, I don't know, it's like, it's so refreshing to see, because you don't see it a lot. It's like, I don't expect that the 9 foot tall blue people is where I'm going to get this stuff in current media, but it is. And I'm going to take it and say, go look at that, because it's really beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's just one of those things where, you know, even just removed from, if you want to remove, for anybody who's listening, the kind of the Christian overtones that you get there with this, right?
Habits.
I mean, just in general, the family itself is the building block of every society, every culture, because without it, humanity dies.
Yeah, totally.
And so the fact that we're seeing a film that is celebrating that family makes us stronger, that we're stronger together as families is really beautiful. And I applaud James Cameron for this. It's one of the things I love so much about the film. And so I did want to ask you, we finally reveal, you know, with Kiri, you know, and her chosen one status.
Immaculate conception.
You know, exactly. And how all that worked. And so I wanted to ask you, what you thought about them kind of bringing that full circle.
Yeah, I think it's good. Like, you know, you kind of figured, I guess, within the first two films how it was going to work. But like, you get the definite answer. There is no father, you know, literally like, she's Navi Jesus. Which is just, it's just funny. It's like, all right, Cameron, like,
Anakin is Star Wars Jesus, basically. It's
not a far-fetched thing, but I think that there's a lot to like about Kiri's arc and what she's going through and kind of her powers. It's very like, she's so into like the world of like, she's so connected to it, which I find very interesting. I think there's still just a lot of questions to be answered about her. Where I'm like, I'm pretty satisfied. Like, I enjoyed what we find out, and obviously her saving Spider, and you know, her connection to Awa and her struggles there, and where Spider and Took help her and all that. Like, it's good. I just have a lot more questions, I think, than we have answers at the moment. And I still think it's weird that Sigourney Weaver's playing a 15-year-old, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's something really interesting, because the whole idea of that, you know, Awa did not choose basically to save Sigourney Weaver's character into the Avatar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what it did was it planted a seed in the Avatar that allowed it to create a clone.
Mm-hmm.
And that clone then has this special relationship with Pandora, because it literally comes from Pandora. It is Pandora. And in some ways, you know, she is the incarnation of Pandora as a being, you know.
Which makes sense why she's so connected to the world itself.
Right. And why she can cause certain things to... Yes. And so Yes, she's basically Navi Jesus.
I mean,
But I thought it was interesting too, because you think about that idea, right? There's a seed planted in the Avatar that creates her. But what does she do? Basically, she plants a seed inside of Spider that allows him then to be able to breathe this air. So this idea of a seed being planted and growing, dude, I mean, you know, that's a biblical thing too. So, you know, there's so many little moments here where, again, what it is it's Cameron using all of these religious overtones to mm-hmm. create, you know, his story. And I find that really interesting. And I think mm-hmm. he did a good job with, you know, staying true to that and not, you know, ever letting go of that, because, you know, that's part of what makes the series the series. And so I did want to ask you about this, because we get some losses in the battle. And for me, you know, we lose, I think you say it, Roddix. I think that's how you say his name.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the kid's friends, but really losing Renal, who is voiced by the incomparable Kate Winslet, who's been pregnant this whole time, whose last act is to give birth to her child before she dies. Man, that one definitely hit hard. And I wanted to ask you about that, because it's like, how did you feel with the fact that that's who we chose basically to let go of?
Yeah, it's tough. I think it's good for Neytiri's character. Because I think we're gonna like it's I think Neytiri, like she's like, will you take care of her? She's like, yeah, I will. Like, I think that's really good. Obviously, yeah, the young boy, Rotox, or however you say his name, he dies in a very, like, unceremonious way. He's just like, he gets, like, shot, and there's, like, a 2-second, like, and it's like, it, like, pans to him, and he's, like, dying, and then we see him at the end, but still, I guess, you know. And then it was a powerful scene where we lose her. I think my only issue with the movie is that, like, I think I wanted someone major to die, which sounds weird. But I was pretty prepared for, like, a big character. Whether that be, like...
Yeah, I hear you.
Whether that be Quaritch, which would have been, you know, that's a whole nother conversation. But, like, if Jake would have died, I think I would have been extremely sad. Because for the first time, this movie has... Like, it started with Way of Water. But I really care about these characters a lot at this point. By the end of this movie. And I think that him or Neytiri dying, someone like that, Loak even, but that's another kid dying, I don't know. I think one of the big ones would have been better for me and what I was expecting. I still think it was a powerful scene. I still think it's a beautiful act to die doing. But I wanted a little bit more. Obviously, James Cameron has something up his sleeve, hopefully, but I don't know. There was still stakes, because I thought the whole time someone was going to die. I thought Jake was going to die.
Yeah.
But it does lose it a little bit for me personally.
It's interesting because, you know, George Lucas is famous for this, in the sense of, like, you know, people, Harrison Ford was like, I got to die in Return of the Jedi. And George was like, no, you know, and you know, he's very much on the side of, like, people don't have to die,
yeah,
to make something powerful.
Don't disagree, yeah.
And so, you know, but man, I just, the Renal character, I thought was, you know, you can't even tell it's Kate Winslet playing her because of the voice. She does such a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the strength of that character is incredibly beautiful, and the celebration of motherhood in that way too. I mean, so to lose her, I see what you're saying, in the sense it would have been interesting to lose somebody a little bit more major. And so
I still do think it's fine. Like, I'm still it probably would have just added to my, because a impactful death, if they do it well, really does make a movie very great, or adds to how great it already is. But I'm okay. Like, I do trust James Cameron clearly with this universe. And I love Jake. He's such a great character.
Yeah, me too.
Seeing more of him doesn't disappoint me.
Sam Worthington, I mean, he's just been so great in this role, and he's really embodied it. But I feel like, you know, everybody's embodied this. I was watching a little behind the scenes stuff, and just like there was this moment where Kate Winslet was talking about where her, you know, spirit sister dies, the Tolkien, and what they show, what she's acting to, is just nothing.
Yeah, that's like, crazy.
She's holding on to a great thing. And it's just like, and it's so, I mean, she's just amazing. And So the fact that they make this look like it does, and this is where I think, you know, the action and effects in this film, I mean, nobody, except for probably Nolan, is making movies that are this consistent in their visual execution, that you never for once are taken out of the movie because something doesn't look right. I mean, I saw this movie in 2D and 3D. I think it's better in 3D just because it's so immersive in that sense, and it's so well done. I mean, it, you know, Cameron understands 3D like nobody else. But, I mean, this movie is flawless because, especially in 3D, those characters, I literally feel like I could reach out and touch them. They feel real. Everything in the world feels real because it's so consistent. It's so well done. And then every action beat is just, you know, it's pretty astounding. I mean, you could probably have some complaints about the last battle feeling a little bit too chaotic, but I just, I'm blown away what they're able to do these days. Well, excuse me, let me rephrase that. What Cameron is able to do.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think from the moment the movie started and they're flying around, I'm like, holy crap, like, this is ridiculous. It looks so real. Like, the wide shots, the action sequences, the close-ups on their face. I'm like, man, if you show this to a person who has never seen a movie before and you're like, here, these are real people, they'd be like, oh my gosh, there's blue people that live. Like, because of how, like, you feel so immersed because of how good it looks. And yeah, I mean, action sequence after action sequence, like wherever they're fighting, whether it's in the sky and they're like dog fighting, which was amazing, or like the hand to hand stuff that they're doing. I'm just like, I don't know. We got to get everybody on. Someone, James Cameron needs to teach a class, do something to like get other filmmakers on board with what he's doing, because there's not a flaw. Like, I guess you could say some things, like there's like half second sequences that if you really look, it looks like a little video gamey, kind of, but like, I'm talking like literal, like split second things where like, I think I accidentally noticed, not like something that the normal person will ever see. What the normal person sees is like, there's not a flaw in these movies visually. And it's like, when you think that Way of Water is like Avatar was amazing. The first one visually, it's like, holy crap. Then you see Way of Water and you're like, whoa, they leveled up. And then even this one, I think they leveled up even further. I'm like, I didn't even know this was possible. It's awesome. It's like,
no, so cool. I love that you said that, because like, you didn't even know this was possible. And I think it speaks to the fact that I saw a post the other day somewhere where it's like VFX is going backwards. And You know, you think about not my favorite movie in the franchise, but the work that they did on Davy Jones, in the Pirates of the Caribbean series, in that second film, is still outstanding and holds up against anything. It looks so good, and and the biggest problem, we've talked about it here before on the show in previous episodes, but there's not enough time. Directors are not clear enough about what they want, and changes are made at last minute. And so if you do that to a VFX team, there's only so much they can do. Cameron knows exactly what he wants. He's built the technology to do this in the same way that Lucas was doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And three, there's enough time.
Yeah.
And so he's not rushing these movies out. You know, he's not pulling a Disney with the sequel trilogy that everything has to come out with, you know, light speed.
Yeah.
He puts these out when he wants to put them out. And so, you know, we could talk about the music, but I think it's great. I don't have any complaints about it. I think Simon Franklin did a great job.
Fantastic.
Yeah, he's killing it. But I think the more important question becomes this. Look, you know, Cameron had talked about this idea that there were five films in this series. And if a fourth one is to come, it's probably not going to come for a few years. You know, Cameron is at this point seems very keen about moving on from Avatar, and that he just wants to make other things. Yet this one's box office is doing well enough that it's like, yeah, they're going to want another one. So
yeah.
I wanted to ask you this. Like, he's talked about the idea that, you know, with the next two, there's going to be a time jump. One, because these kids are a lot older now anyway, and so there has to be. But with the way this film ends, is this... should he just let this go and then go do other things, or do you want to see him return to the world of Pandora?
I mean, it's like at this point, how could I not want him to return? Like, he's made amazing movies outside of Avatar. Like, I love Aliens, I love the Terminators. You know, like, I haven't seen The Abyss, but I hear The Abyss is great. Like, Titanic. Like, all these. He's a fantastic director. But my fear is, because there is more story to tell. I don't know what you think, but I don't think Korich is dead. Like, he falls off in this weird way, and we don't see a body. Varang went somewhere. Like, there's more story to tell. I want more story from this. And I think he could give it over to somebody, but I just don't think it would be the same. I think he needs to complete the story that he originally intended with like an epic conclusion type thing that like culminates. And then he can be done. But if he's done, it'd be sad, I think. I want more from him in this specifically. I know he's like, he wants to make a movie about Hiroshima that he's talked about, but I guess we'll see. But I think from the consistent increase in quality of these movies, at least for me, and just in general, people love these movies. I think continuing the story with him behind the camera would be a wise decision for him.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things he's talked about, too, is the idea of, you know, maybe not being so hands-on and letting somebody else, you know, help him. And in the sense that even if he does direct, you know, maybe not being as hands-on at every tiny little piece. And possibly, I think you could do that now that you've made three of these films and people know what you
want.
Keep
your team, yeah.
And so I think the thing that makes this feel like it could work is that by doing a time jump, it means that we are most likely going to be dealing with different themes. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that it's wise, if you continue, that Quaritch is dead and that the main villains become the Ash. And this becomes not about human versus Na'vi, but this becomes about the worldview of different Na'vi, one who basically want to destroy the world and watch it burn, and others who want to protect it. And I think that would be a much more interesting story to tell, because that Sigourney Weaver has said that she's the main character going forward. And that would make sense then for her to be the main character. If that's the story you're telling, because I don't think there's really anything left to tell with Quaritch. I think it's actually more interesting to have him dead and say, hey, you know, he's the character who literally had every choice to turn around and chose to die instead of that.
Yeah, I guess I wish he died in a more in a different way. It's climactic, I guess. But also very on brand for his character at the same time.
It's true. This is awkward.
Yeah. And then he's just like, well, no, but I agree. I think getting more Varang and more Na'vi is definitely a move that would be the best. I saw in an interview today, James Cameron was talking about Neytiri not knowing what snow was. And I was like, snow would be so cool in this world. Like, give me that. Like, that would be awesome too. So, because, I mean, we're just in a section of Pandora. It's a big planet, you know? So give me more of that. Give me more Wind Traders, more Ash people. The RDA stuff, I understand why it has to be a part of it, but I don't care nearly as much. They're just kind of a piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, and I think that too, it feels to me at this point that it is played out, right? I mean, with the loss of the general there on the planet and everything, mm-hmm. that feels like a storyline you can let go of, and then it is much more interesting to then just deal with the planet of Pandora on its own terms in that sense. So, where are you going to be on your ratings for Avatar, Fire, and Ash, Rye?
I saw it once on Friday it came out. I gave it a 4.5. And then I saw it yesterday. And even after, I'm still sticking with 4.5. I could go up to a 5. Like, I love this thing. I get that some of it's kind of messy, but it's like a beautiful mess. It's like, it's Cameron's Avatar's version of like At World's End or Dark of the Moon, like these big giant blockbusters that are dealing with a lot of things that, I love it. I'm sticking with 4.5 at the moment. Where are you at?
So I've seen it twice. I saw it once in 2D, once in 3D, mm-hmm. and, I got to see IMAX where I had the 6-minute prologue.
Dude,
that's a whole other podcast. The
Odyssey. Right there. You talk for an hour about
so
that.
So good! Anyway, for The Odyssey, for people who don't know.
I'll be
know
on
what
that episode
about.
Next year if you want to talk about that.
Dude, it's going to be so great. I think right now with Fire and Ash, I am at a 4 out of 5. And the reason is because there is. This is not as tight as Way of Water was, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that doesn't take anything away, though, that this movie takes Way of Water thematically, and I think expounds on that in a way that I personally just, that's what gets me going with mm-hmm. film, right?
Yeah, totally.
But I can't negate the fact that I can recognize that, like you said, I think you said it really well. It is a beautiful mess mm-hmm. in that sense. It is just not as clean and tight feeling. And part of that is just because, too, I think Cameron didn't do as well with the editing between the different stories as somebody like I've seen Lucas do. Again, like Way of Water was a much more kind of like very tight story just with who we're focused on, where all the characters are, all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. This one, I mean, we're following lots
everywhere.
Of different stories. Yeah. We're all over the place. And so, but again, I really enjoyed this movie. And I think, this is the end of the Avatar franchise. I think that Cameron can absolutely hold his head high. He should be very proud. He's created a series to which mm-hmm. I will go back and rewatch now. I mean, this is a trilogy that I'll enjoy doing the the rewatch of. Mm-hmm. And it's a long
rewatch.
So it's like the Lord of the Rings, extended versions. But it's great, and I'm glad that I feel that way, because the mm-hmm. last thing you want to have happen when you have the thought process of a trilogy is that the third one's a letdown.
Yeah.
And this one didn't let me down in that sense. So, but Ryan,
finally the one I connected with.
There you go, man. So here, if people wanted to catch up with you, see what else you've got going on, or maybe talk to you about Avatar or other films, where would they find you?
Just on, at the moment, go on Instagram at Rye Talks About. You'll get every update I post for movies and if I start podcasting again.
Nice. And you're on Letterboxd, right?
I am on Letterboxd at 182nd, O-N-E-82-N-D.
Yes. You can find me all over the place, of course, on social media, the name Matt Rushing 02. If I am on that platform, that's the name. Of course, on the network, you'll find me with Chris Jones, a lot of great Star Trek talk, talking all those things with him. We're excited to be back next year and really dive back more into that. And over on the Nerd Party Network, you'll find me with a couple of shows. One's called Outpost, about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, and Aggressive Negotiations, talking about Star Wars each and every week with the great John Mills. But thank you so much for joining us this year, and y'all come back now, you hear? We'll be right back.